From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
9:15 on a Sunday morning, a special edition of America's Newsroom. It certainly is a historic day.
Right, we are back on a very historic day as we're watching all this unfold.
There's discussions, there's protesters everywhere. Lots of excitement on this big historic day. So you're going to
every week, historic or otherwise, the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism surveys news coverage across the media. Last week, the health care bill was far and away the leading story, and yet, despite the news media's devotion to the topic, a CBS News poll found that more than half of Americans say they still don't understand how health care reform will affect them. Mark Jerkowitz is the associate director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. He says that while newspapers and networks devoted about a third of their space to the issue and websites about 20%, it was cable and radio talk shows that owned the story. In fact, they devoted a staggering 80% of their news hole to health care.
From day one, this story has very much been a talk show story. The cable and radio talk shows have devoted the most time to it. And that's different, for example, than The Economy, which was actually a story that we found was covered more in like network TV and newspapers.
Did the venue determine to some degree the nature of the coverage?
To some degree, that's true. Any story that generates this much attention in cable and radio talk shows, which are highly ideological, you're going to get competing and argumentative versions of the truth. Our sister organization, the Research Center for the People and the Press, asked a series of questions throughout last year about whether or not the healthcare debate was easy to understand or hard to understand. When they first asked the question in July, I believe about 63% of the people said it was hard to understand. When they asked it in December, 69% of people said.
It's interesting. It's not the first time there seems to have been an inverse relationship between certain kinds of media consumption and understanding of an issue. There was a poll, I think, after the first Gulf War that asked people about the context of the war, the nations involved, and so forth. And it turned out that the more people watched cable news, the less informed they were. In fact, the only area in which they seemed to know more than those who didn't get their primary information from cable news was that they could identify the Patriot missile.
Certainly, those cable news shows at night, they're siblings of talk radio. Depending on who the host is, you're either getting a liberal or conservative argument that you may or may not believe. On many of those shows, the traditional journalistic idea of let's get to the truth or the nearest version of the truth we can find is supplanted by the idea of, hey, if guy A is going to argue this, we'll bring on guy B to argue the polar opposite. And, you know, basically leaves people sort of making decisions through the prism of their own ideology often. And let's say this about the healthcare debate, in all fairness. This is a very complicated issue. This was a very complicated legislative process. You had partisans and politicians on both sides of the issue who were characterizing it in a self-serving way that also left people wondering what the real version of the facts were. So you got a perfect storm of confusion in some ways in this story.
And a place where the media, I assume, are supposed to step in and help clarify. You know, I was watching CNN the night of the vote, and they kept referring to how the bill was going to go to the Senate for some fixes. They never said what they were, not once. They had so much time to fill. All Wolf Blitzer did was stare at the clock and say, now we've got 200 votes and 216 is the magic number. Three times he did that. Somebody could have mentioned some of the leading fixes. I had to wait for a chart in the New York Times.
Look, the Fox News Channel, with a decidedly ideological look in primetime, has been the success story in terms of audience and ratings on cable news. MSNBC, which for years floundered in primetime, would probably say that they've achieved a good deal of success making themselves the ideological polar opposite of the Fox News Channel in primetime, and they're happy with that. CNN, in some respects, the one cable network now that is not overtly ideological in terms of the orientation of its primetime host, has in some ways been struggling the most. So it may well be that they've decided, hey, the people who are going to follow us now are essentially pretty hardcore political junkies, and they really do want opinionated political coverage. That may, in fact, be the working theorem, and it may be correct.
Mark, thank you so much.
Brooke, you're welcome.
Mark Jerkowitz is the associate director of the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism. political journalists covering the health care reform process suffered a malady that often afflicts members of their breed, horse race fever. They spent most of their time guessing whether the bill would pass or fail, and mostly they guessed wrong. When Democratic Congressman Alan Grayson went on Chris Matthews' MSNBC show Hardball in January and told him that Senate Democrats planned to pass the bill using the reconciliation process, Matthews scoffed.
Do you want to bet 30 days or less we will have a health care bill passed through the process of reconciliation?
I believe so.
You predict it?
Because America needs it.
You predict it?
I think it's the most likely option at this point.
I will make a side bet. It's not going to happen anyway.
It happened, though it took 2 months, not the 30 days Grayson had predicted. Dan Gross is a columnist at Slate and Newsweek. He's got a theory about why the pundits would have gone broke if bets like Matthews had involved actual cash. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
Ever since Scott Brown's election to fill Ted Kennedy's seat in January, it's been the conventional wisdom on the health care reform bill that it was going to fail. That was, of course, until it didn't. Now, you found a way to measure that conventional wisdom. What did you do?
Well, there's a political futures market called Intrade where people trade contracts based on current events. You know, who will win this election? Will health care pass by June 2010? And those have a monetary value. They pay off at 100 if the event happens, and if they pay off at 0 if it doesn't happen.
It's gambling.
And after Brown was elected, people thought there was only a 1 in 5 chance of it happening by June. And even as late as mid-March, when passage was just 3 days away, people were only giving it an 80% chance, even at a time when the vote seemed to be locked up.
So what is the conventional wisdom derived from?
I think those futures trading are just people parroting the conventional wisdom that they're reading in the media. They're reading the polls, they're watching talking heads, and the prevailing narrative about healthcare was it wasn't going to happen. Even after both the House and the Senate had passed it, they still thought it wasn't going to happen.
Why were the media so wrong?
I think basically since Obama's appearance on the scene, the establishment and the media in general have essentially shorted him. In other words,
sold him short.
They've sold him short. If he was a stock, they would be betting that he would fail. The Clintons shorted him. The media shorted him. Remember when he couldn't win because of Reverend Wright, he couldn't get white voters. The GOP shorted him. Obviously, they thought they were going to beat him pretty handily. Econo pundits, Michael Boskin, who was the Bush economic advisor, wrote this famous op-ed in the Wall Street Journal in March 2009 saying Obama's radicalism is killing the Dow. The Dow has risen 70% since then. It's in the media, it's in the economic world, in this whole sort of complex of talking headdom.
So why have the media shorted him?
Well, the simplest argument is that most of the people talking about this on TV and in print and online don't know what they're talking about. I mean, if you're looking for deep political wisdom from Wolf Blitzer, you know, that's like fishing for manta rays in the Gowanus Canal. But one of the reasons I think is that so much of what we've seen in the last couple years is unprecedented. We never had an African-American candidate before. In most people's lifetimes, we have not seen an economy that was shrinking at a 6% annual rate. When people are encountered with things that haven't happened before, they have a tough time predicting what's going to happen. On top of that, I think there is this larger narrative that, you know, the Democrats are incompetent. They screwed up health care. They screwed up their majorities when they had them in 93, 94. Therefore, they will do so again. I think one of the other reasons people thought health care was doomed was because of the success in sort of mainlining and mainstreaming GOP talking points. There are substantial chunks of the media, the Wall Street Journal editorial page and increasingly its news pages, Fox News, a online publication that rhymes with Schmolitico, that effectively give over huge amounts of space to publishing Republican talking points.
How do you make this coverage better reflect reality?
I think one of the things we have to do is get away from the culture of stenography, which is the people who consider themselves the straight-up political reporters. They will ask someone for a quote, what do you think about healthcare? And then John Boehner said, well, it means Armageddon, it's the end of freedom, which is an absurd thing to say. But you have to get a Democratic quote, a Republican quote, a liberal quote, a conservative quote. And what you end up doing when you do that is just regurgitating talking points that don't have any real relevance to what the debate is about. You know, if you need a quote and you do need quotes to fill out your pieces, why include the one that you know is absurd from the left or the right?
Fair enough. Daniel, thank you so much.
Anytime.
Daniel Gross is a columnist for Slate and Newsweek.
Many observed that after this week, that Schoolhouse Rock classic, How a Bill Becomes a Law, is due for a rewrite. So, here it is.
Hey, kids, I'm Bill the Bill. Want to hear how I might become a law?
Yeah!
It's simple. Just follow along. Come on. Someone writes me, I get a sponsor. Committee's where I go first. Once through committee, I go to the floor, and that's where they debate.
Sounds fun!
Totally. Then they vote, they vote.
It's a vote!
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
If I pass here, off to the second house of Congress, then I go to you-know-who.
The president?
Yup.
And just like that, you're a law?
Well, unless I get tied up in a series of dilatory motions, nuisance amendments, and quorum calls. Poison pills or filibusters?
Poison pills? That's scary.
What's a filibusters?
Don't worry about those. With a cloture vote, you can cut off debate. You just need a supermajority in the Senate. If you don't have 60 votes, you can shove it through with plenty of parliamentary tactics.
Gosh, is that fair?
Sure it's fair. They're all in the rules somewhere.
Is it over then?
Yeah. Once the bill is signed by the president and sent back to the Senate to vote on the differences in the reconciled legislation, unless the parliamentarian rules that any of the bits to be reconciled fail the Byrd test, then it goes back to the House for another vote, and if it passes, it's a law. It's that simple.
Bill.
Now it's a law. Now it's a law. Brooke, Bob, come over here.
Oh, all right.
Come on, step up the mic.
Now it's a law. Now it's a law. It's not a bill anymore. Now it's a law, not a bill anymore.
Unless it's overturned by the Supreme Court 5-2-4.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. After so much argument, why couldn't the politicians just give the people what they want? I mean, it was so obvious.
All I know is that the American people are adamantly opposed to this health bill.
Americans want health care reform by overwhelming majority.
We know from the polling that's been done in this country how the American people feel.
The problem, of course, is that Americans' expressed desires had everything to do with when and what the pollsters asked, not to mention the words they chose to ask it. At the beginning of March, Gallup surveyed the public's opinion of health care reform. It found that 45% were for it, 48% against it, and 7% had no opinion. But if you dug a little deeper, you found that the second reason people gave for why they were against it was that it, quote, doesn't address real problems. And the third was that they simply, quote, need more information. Not exactly the open and shut case the critics and advocates needed to claim they were doing the people's will. And the Gallup poll was just one of many that raised more questions than answers. Gary Langer directs polling for ABC News. Gary, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bob.
You wrote that quote, "It's been a simple matter for just about anyone to mischaracterize public opinion on health care reform." What would you say are the greatest sins of mischaracterization?
Well, claiming that we have large majorities of Americans either in support of or in opposition to health care reform would be a mischaracterization. There are elements of reform that are popular. There are other elements that are off-putting. Put it together, you're getting about an even split, and it's been that way for months.
Did the GOP kind of lump into their notion of public dissatisfaction not only those against too much government spending, but those who saw the bill as not going far enough?
I don't know what the Republican Party is doing with the data that it's presenting, but I can tell you that the poll that I've seen that's had the largest level of opposition to reform, 59%, includes 13% within that 59 who say it's not liberal enough.
But if you leave out that little detail, you can say overwhelmingly opposed and technically be telling the truth. I use the word technically advisedly.
Well, you can. At the same time, that was a CNN poll, and the pollster who did it took the trouble to ask that follow-up question and to report it.
But what about the media? Have we permitted scoundrels to, you know, misrepresent the true breadth of public opinion?
Look, the news media have long indulged themselves in the lazy luxury of being both data-hungry and math-phobic. Anytime a newsmaker, an interview subject, a politician, a pundit cites data, we really need to hear where that data came from. There have been politicians and pundits on both sides of this issue who have tried to claim the mantle of popularity. That's true on almost any issue. It is important, to the extent we can, to call them on it. We have to overcome this notion that life can be boiled down, in this case, to a single number. There's more complexity there. You know, any other news that comes in over the transom, we check it out before we report it because that's our responsibility. If it's polling data, it's too sexy, it's too compelling, we're all English majors, and we just want to pick it up and use it. We need to stop and check this stuff out, too. That is happening more at some good news organizations, but not enough at enough of them.
All right, Gary. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Gary Langer is director of polling for ABC News.
Can you hear us now? Can you hear us now? Can you hear us now? Can you hear us now?
Protesters opposed to the health care bill gathered around the U.S. Capitol last weekend as lawmakers filed in to cast their votes. And amidst the protests, a few incidents made headlines. Congressman Emanuel Cleaver was spat on as he passed the crowd. One protester shouted the N-word at Congressman John Lewis, a civil rights pioneer, and another yelled a homophobic slur at gay Congressman Barney Frank. Some media outlets attributed the incidents to the so-called Tea Party movement, but Tea Partiers object, charging that most news outlets essentially ignore them until episodes like this allow the media to portray them as a band of crazies. David Weigel is the senior reporter for the Washington Independent. He's been covering the Tea Parties since their inception, and very soon he'll be on the Tea Party beat as a new blogger at the Washington Post. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Is the Tea Party movement a bona fide movement?
It's uniting a bunch of movements that already existed. Religious groups that have been around for a while, like Focus on the Family, libertarian groups like Freedom Works, and old political hands. I mean, I just was talking today to Virginia Thomas, the wife of Clarence Thomas, who's a longtime D.C. political activist and has started a Tea Party group. Since they identify themselves with the movement, I think that's a good starting point.
So if you're a news organization and you want to cover the movement, do you focus on the kind of old line libertarians? Do you focus on the intersection between the Tea Partiers and the GOP? Or do you focus on the guys at the paramilitary camps stocking up on ammo and canned goods?
I try and grab all those things. The only thing I try not to do is what I call point and laugh coverage, where you find a Tea Party group doing something kind of crazy and make fun of that and move on. The Tea Parties have been covered as first as an oddity and then as a phenomenon. The sad, boring truth is that they're in the middle. There was a speculation in the beginning of these rallies that this was a new political force. It might become a third-party force. For now, they've just jumped right back into the Republican Party fold.
We've discussed point and laugh. Tell me about the other way that the press typically has mischaracterized the movement.
The other way is just taking a press release from one of these Tea Party groups and reporting that this was an authentic American uprising that informs our understanding of why Barack Obama is not very popular right now. There's some polling to back this up. The simple answer is that the economy is bad. It's not that the self-selected conservative protester showing up somewhere is the voice of the independents. They're neither freaks nor Norman Rockwell representations of every American.
So on the subject of point and laugh stories, this wasn't point and laugh so much as point and get in a heated argument. Mm. This is Susan Rosgen of CNN at a Tea Party protest in Chicago trying to interview some guy with a sign that showed President Obama as Hitler. The reporter got a whole lot of criticism for confronting the people she was nominally interviewing.
What is this supposed to mean? What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, he's a fascist. The pirates...
Wait, why do you say he's pirates? A fascist? He's the president of the United States.
He's a fascist.
Do you realize how offensive that is?
I think he's a fascist.
Why?
Because he is.
In what way can you say that?
because the real pirates are in the White House and the Senate.
The way that CNN reporter behaved in that case was over the top, but the theory behind what she was doing, there's nothing wrong with that. If you engage Tea Party activists and actually fact-check their claims instead of just stenographing and saying, here's what they said, on some issues, they're going to know more than the press, and they're going to be right. On some issues, they're going to be wrong. I mean, I think a lot of Tea Partiers would win debates with a reporter on what is actually in the health care bill and what page it's on. But a Tea Party activist might say something along the lines of, when Ronald Reagan cut taxes in 1981, we pulled out of the recession. That's actually not true. I mean, things like that about pretty recent American history and pretty recent economic history don't get fact-checked. And I think a result of that is that people with bullhorns and signs are able to sort of change the accepted history of economics in America.
On the day of the final healthcare vote, a lot of the focus was on some crazies who were shouting various bigoted remarks at legislators. Some in the movement have complained that they're being tarred with the same brush as these, you know, over-the-top bigots. Is it unfair to pay too much attention to the worst of the lot?
Well, it's news when somebody gets spit on. It's a problem, actually, that Tea Partiers are dealing with. In the aftermath of the healthcare vote, there are many stories of members of Congress getting a death threat, getting an angry protest outside their house. It's a reality of protest. It's something that activists confront if they're building bigger and bigger crowds and getting more and more of a froth about the issues. I just think it's important the media doesn't just cover when somebody steps that obviously over the line. You need to dig into the policy objections, which are sometimes rooted in resentments about class and race. And it's tough to do that in a way that doesn't scream out bias to your readers. But if you leave it out, that's a different kind of bias. You need to make sure that in covering this, you get every angle and you understand why exactly they're protesting, not just why they tell you that they're protesting.
David, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
David Weigel is a senior reporter for the Washington Independent and soon will be blogging about the Tea Party movement for the Washington Post.
During debate last weekend on the health care bill, Republican Congressman Randy Neugebauer of Texas yelled out, "It's a baby killer," on the House floor. Later, he said that he was referring to the bill itself, not Representative Bart Stupak, a Democrat of Michigan who was then speaking at the podium. Nevertheless, it quickly generated headlines as one of history's most notable legislative outbursts. Of course, Neugebauer joins legions of those who have invoked this powerful defamation. American University professor Alan Lichtman says that the phrase holds a prominent place in the catalog of public accusations.
That's right. Even as applied to so-called abortionists, the term baby killer dates back at least to 1894 in the United States. In that year, the Associated Press published a story about a raid on the office of alleged abortionists. Of course, in those days, abortion was illegal, and they called the abortionists the baby killers. And the story was extremely lurid, although brief, and it talked about finding dead babies on the floor of the office and condemned the unnamed, unknown perpetrators as the baby killers of 1894. So sensationalizing the whole issue, the sensitive emotional issue of abortion, is absolutely nothing new. It dates back well over 100 years in American history.
But of course, the use of the phrase baby killer isn't limited to abortion. In the early 20th century, you say that peddlers of patent medicines were sometimes called baby killers. How come?
Public health reformers in the early 20th century, around the year 1910, launched a campaign against these patent medicines, you know, Dr. Curall's magic elixir, because it turned out that a lot of these were quite toxic and were at least implicated in the deaths of babies. And these patent medicines were damned as the baby killers.
But it sounds like these patent medicines were killing babies. Prohibitionists also use the term?
prohibitionists in the early 20th century called the saloon the baby killer. And of course, the reference here was indirect. The argument was that the saloon contributed to turning good husbands into bad husbands, making them wife beaters, even child beaters, causing them to lose their jobs, to break up their families, and all of these things could ultimately result in the deaths of babies.
And it's a phrase that has seen repeated service during wartime. Many of us can remember, at least there were reports of anti-war activists yelling baby killer at returning Vietnam vets. It's also been used by government propaganda units and the military to demonize the enemy. We can start with Winston Churchill during the First World War.
Winston Churchill, then head of the British Navy, seized on the naval bombardment of the town of Scarborough to brand the Germans as the baby killers of Scarborough. Of course, the Germans responded, well, look, the British are blockading Germany. They're depriving us of medicines and foodstuffs and maybe indirectly killing far more babies. But somehow the idea of blowing babies to bits in bombardment had more resonance. And there were stories of Germans singing and laughing and bayoneting children in the streets. An iconic image of the war that demonized the Germans was the image of a young child with his hands cut off. Now, the Germans did kill a lot of civilians, and undoubtedly the British blockade did too, but these particular atrocity stories were later shown to be false, and again were part of the demonization of the enemy and the attempt to whip up public opinion.
The accusation of baby killing resurfaced during the Second World War, and once again in 1991, in the run-up to the first Gulf War, there was a young woman who appeared before a kind of unofficial congressional committee to talk about Iraqis seizing babies from Kuwaiti incubators in Kuwait City and dashing them to the ground.
While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators, and left the children to die on the cold floor.
Congresspersons repeated the story. President George H.W. Bush repeated the story.
Kids in incubators, and they were thrown out of the incubators so that Kuwait could be systematically dismantled.
Amnesty International picked up on the story. Later it was shown this young woman was an absolute plant. She was a member of the Kuwaiti royal family, and she was the daughter of the ambassador to the United States. She had not been a nurse in a hospital. She had not witnessed any of these events. These events were pure fabrications planted by the Kuwaiti royal family, obviously, who had a great interest in the United States intervening to drive out the Iraqis and restore royal control over Kuwait.
And they did it with the assistance of the American public relations firm Hill & Knowlton.
Hill & Knowlton planned the campaign with the explicit aim of getting the United States to go into war. And it worked.
You know, it strikes me that another altogether different context in which baby killer is used as an accusation is in the mid-1970s against the Nestle Corporation. In that case, there are actual dead babies involved.
Absolutely. And in this case, the accusations were that by marketing formula in the Third World for babies and essentially discouraging breastfeeding, Nestle Corporation was contributing to the ill health and indeed, if indirectly, to the documented deaths of many babies. It was a pamphlet that was published called The Baby Killers, directly relating to Nestle's operations in the Third World, and the publicity was quite devastating.
Bringing this back to abortion, more recently, Dr. George Tiller, who performed abortions and was murdered by an anti-abortion activist, was nicknamed Tiller the Baby Killer, and it was a phrase that was often repeated by Bill O'Reilly on the O'Reilly Factor.
Dr. George Tiller, known as Tiller the Baby Killer, as some call him, the notorious Tiller the Baby Killer.
I wanted George Tiller and Tiller the Baby Killer going, yay!
If you want to kill a baby, you hire Tiller, you got to pay him $5,000 up front, and he'll kill the baby.
Certainly, when you call a particular individual a baby killer, that is definitely an incitement to vigilante action because you're essentially placing them outside the pale of our common humanity.
So what should we think when we hear the term being used?
We should think that this is not a appropriate term for political dialogue. You foreclose the possibility of any kind of reason or negotiation. Back in 1979, when Nellie Gray, the founder of the March for Life, was approached to try to reach some kind of compromise with the pro-choice movement, she responded, "I do not sit down and negotiate with baby killers." This argument is not about whether one side or another is more pro-life, that is, cherishes life more. Both sides, we can say, cherish life. The difference is a fundamentally core, unresolvable dispute about when life begins.
Alan, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Alan Lichtman is a professor of history at American University in Washington, D.C.
Coming up, NPR changes its terminology on the abortion debate and a conversation with the head of Al Jazeera.
Our newsroom is actually a celebration of democracy, a celebration of diversity. People are arguing, debating, discussing. They believe in what they do, and they are willing to sacrifice.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Way back in 1990, I was the editor of All Things Considered. And when I wrote news copy depicting legislators and their views on abortion, I would classify them as either anti-abortion or supporters of abortion rights. But about 5 years ago, that language changed. And up until this week, you could hear hosts and reporters using terms like pro-choice or pro-life to describe those divided over abortion, as in this clip of NPR's health policy correspondent Julie Rovner speaking on Talk of the Nation on Tuesday.
The Senate bill ultimately got the president to issue an executive order. The pro-choice Democrats weren't very happy about it, but basically...
On Wednesday, NPR News policy officially changed that language back. NPR News managing editor David Sweeney is responsible for the change. So, David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brooke. Nice to be on the show.
If Julie were characterizing those Democrats today, instead of calling them pro-choice, what would she call them?
Well, she could call them abortion rights advocates. She could call them anti-abortion rights advocates or any derivatives thereof. We decided that with abortion back in the news, with health care, that we needed to take a look at our existing guidelines. So senior news management sat down and we had a conversation and we agreed that pro-life and pro-choice were not the clearest, most consistent or neutral descriptors that we could use.
You know, it's weird how everything old is new again, because 20 years ago when I was there, it was determined that if you were going to use phrases like pro-choice and pro-life, even if you used both of them, they don't cancel each other out. They're still basically carrying water for those advocates. I know you weren't responsible 5 years ago for the adoption of those terms. Do you have any notion why they would accept them, except for the fact that they're short?
I don't, to be honest with you. I mean, I think we try to stick to, you know, reporting facts without using language that's highly charged that one side or the other uses in their narratives.
In the reporting on this, we read that the news managers who were responsible for the change, who signed it, can't remember doing it. They're no longer with NPR. Isn't that weird? Did any NPR listeners complain about pro-life and pro-choice?
Yes, we got complaints. Actually, I spoke to one of the editors who's been covering the abortion story for many years, and he said when the change was made in 2005, he was expecting a much bigger reaction than we actually got. We certainly get a lot of mail around it, but our coverage of the Middle East gets about 3 to 5 times more responses than what we say on abortion. You know, for the record, is NPR perfect? Do we get everything right? No. Are there times when we've used language and stories that perhaps could have been better? Of course, but, you know, that's part of my job to work with the editors and reporters to make sure we get it as right, as correct and as factual most of the time as possible.
And I would see this definitely as a correction, but why did it take so long to get this neutral language back into the NPR style book?
In hindsight, would it have been better to have a meeting 2 weeks ago? Maybe. You know, I had been looking at what other news organizations use. I'd been talking to editors about it. But because a lot of the editors who deal with abortion were involved in our healthcare coverage, everybody was, you know, always busy. So it just happened that we got round to scheduling the meeting for this week.
Can you tell me, was there much argument within NPR about switching this language back to what it was 5 years ago?
We had a good discussion, but I think there was pretty much unanimity on Wednesday afternoon that this is the direction in which we wanted to go.
All right, David. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke. Nice to be on the show.
David Sweeney is the managing editor of NPR News. In the Middle East, a region roiling with economic disparity, repressive government, religious intolerance, Western meddling, and Western neglect, a revolutionary force has arisen that no one could anticipate, a truly independent news outlet of nearly unbounded influence. Al Jazeera, launched by the Emir of Qatar in 1996 and built by journalists trained at the BBC, now comprises a series of satellite channels reaching hundreds of millions of homes around the world. Al Jazeera's bureaus have been tossed out of nearly every country of the Middle East by angry governments. The Bush White House often attacked Al Jazeera's war coverage, and U.S. missiles struck its bureaus more than once in what the Pentagon called accidents. As the years pass, Al Jazeera's reach and influence and coverage from Sudan to Haiti to Iowa expands. But though the Al Jazeera English channel is available in Washington, D.C., so far it lacks an American distributor. Wada Khanfar is Director General of Al Jazeera. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Do you see a big difference in how you cover stories in the region versus how Western journalists cover them?
Yes, I do. Because we are living in the region, we do understand the accumulative history, memory, and culture of that region. So definitely Al Jazeera has introduced a different way of reporting the Middle East.
There is a cultural and historical frame that Al Jazeera can apply to reporting the events in the region that Western reporters, reporters from elsewhere, can't use.
A lot of reporters, when they come to the region, they just start from the last few minutes news, as if the story has just been developing, without understanding that the story in the Middle East, in particular the Middle East, has great historical and cultural and religious connection.
So you've distinguished between Al Jazeera and foreign reporters. Can you distinguish between Al Jazeera and the state of the Arab media in general?
No doubt. I mean, Al Jazeera in 1996, when we started, we initiated this culture of independent journalism. So this is why most of the Arab governments did stand against Al Jazeera. Most of our reporters were jailed. Some of our bureaus were closed down. And until today, we face a lot of difficulty. But of course, now Al Jazeera has become a reality. Therefore, governments have to deal with it.
It's far more than a reality. According to the Columbia Journalism Review, and I have a couple of questions based on that article, Al Jazeera is so influential, it has the power to kill the Middle East peace process.
Maybe what the article said about our influence is correct. But the peace process itself is going through huge difficulty. The process itself is not working. So this is why when we reflect on reality, we are not actually making it. We are trying to report independently on evidence.
Let me talk about a couple of the cases that CJR cited, and you can tell me what you think about them. One of them has to do with Al Jazeera's coverage of the Goldstone Report. That was the UN investigation of war crimes during the 2009 Gaza War. Israel was found to be guilty of a range of violations. The White House pressured Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to defer discussion to the UN. The White House was trying to reopen peace talks, and they thought that this would be a negotiation killer. Al Jazeera's primetime talk shows and newscasts practically every day focused on Abbas's capitulation. CJR credits Al Jazeera's immense influence in creating such a dust-up within Fatah, Abbas's party, that he had to reverse his position. There were calls for his resignation and so on. Are you saying that that impact wasn't intentional?
We are not definitely like channels whereby we mix comment and opinion with the news. I have been watching the debate about the healthcare in this country. And I can tell you frankly that a lot of channels, when they are debating this issue, it's very clear for me who is coming from outside this country that they are taking side. It is not the case in Al Jazeera.
Did anybody take the side for Abbas's position?
Of course. I mean, Abbas's position was presented on the screen from the first moment. The first guy who came out publicly to speak about Goldstone report was from Abbas' team. It is not from the opposition. The issue of Goldstone, it was a huge story. It was too big to be ignored.
And you disagree with the Columbia Journalism Review that you turn the tide against Abbas's decision by a preponderance of coverage that was intensely critical every single day, twice a day.
We have to challenge centers of power when they are trying to hide facts. Facts. People should learn that governments from now on cannot brush away stories and cannot hide the truth, and they cannot just come out publicly in front of the screen, say things and deceive people without giving proper evidence and without being accountable for what they are doing.
Can I give you one more example?
Please.
In July of last year, a prominent Fatah member, Farouk al-Qadoumi, made a surprise announcement at a press conference in Amman, Jordan, that Abbas and an accomplice had conspired to kill Yasser Arafat. Many Palestinian analysts quickly concluded that his documents were bogus, but Al Jazeera's coverage kept the conspiracy alive, doing more damage to Abbas. Do you think that Al Jazeera was fair?
We did not, in Al Jazeera, campaign for Farouk al-Qadoumi. We did not say Farouk al-Qadoumi is magnificent and correct. Actually, we grilled him. When we interviewed Farouk al-Qadoumi that night, he had a tough time on Al Jazeera because our anchor was challenging him about his evidence. But he is the second in command in Fatah, accusing his boss of conspiring against Yasser Arafat, who is the previous boss. This is a huge story.
When somebody in power says something that is extremely unlikely or untrue, how much attention do you give it day after day? Do you report it once? Do you report it twice? Do you keep reporting it, even when you know that it's bogus?
We never said that Farouk al-Qadoumi was right or wrong. We invited Fatah to come on. We invited Mahmoud Abbas and his team in order to give explanation. And they came. And they dismissed the document. They were given much more than equal time. Some people wanted us to not to talk about it. I don't think it is fair. This is the first time we have high-profile politician within the institution, the Palestinian institution, coming publicly and talking about it. That was the issue.
And do you have internal arguments? Do you have different factions within Al Jazeera that argue one case or another? And how do you adjudicate those?
Yes, we do have argument. We do have differences. We sit down for hours and hours. Actually, I told the guys our newsroom looks like a think tank rather than just another newsroom. It is not quiet like other newsrooms which I visit. You know, sometimes I go around, I find magnificent, neatly arranged newsrooms where people are busy, just everyone doing his. No, our newsroom is actually a celebration of democracy, a celebration of diversity. People are arguing, debating, discussing. They believe in what they do and they are willing to sacrifice. They have escaped from the tyranny of government-sponsored broadcasters. And they have escaped from the tyranny of intelligence agencies and governments who wanted them to say whatever they want these governments to be said. They came to us because they feel there is freedom.
When do you think Al Jazeera is most challenged when it comes to fairness? In a region where you are so influential, I would think that you have to be constantly examining yourself.
Yes. The region that we are in is very complicated. We have 8 hot spots: Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, Iran, Palestine. You know, all these kind of issues are complicated. Not only that, we have Sunnis, Shiis, Arabs, Kurds, and so on and so forth. So we cannot afford to take side. We can afford only, when it comes to the issues related to the region, to examine and re-examine ourselves. This is why we have daily reports about our fairness presented to our editorial board. This is why we are the only TV station that I know of that opens air for audience to phone in and to criticize and to correct our coverage. Our credibility is our capital. If we lose it, we are out of business.
You can't afford to play sides within the region. What about sides outside the region? We know that it's a region that feels very beset by Western powers coming in and mucking about. And you have that cultural frame. Do you think that that cultural regional frame enables you to report fairly on the actions and the motives of the world outside?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Of course, there is nothing called absolute objectivity when it comes to issues related to the human being. However, at least we try to be aware of our biases. Let us take America, the biggest player in the region. We were victims of the American pressure on us. Al Jazeera Bureau in Kabul was attacked by American jet fighters. Al Jazeera Bureau in Baghdad was attacked. Correspondents were killed, arrested, tortured. A cameraman spent 6.5 years in Guantanamo, you know. So we have been under pressure, but we have never, ever used the screen to settle our dispute with the American administration when it comes to the issue related to the region. Whenever there is an opinion related to the Americans, an American spokesperson from the military or politician comes on the screen and defends and speaks and responds. Unfortunately, we have been accused. The channel that broadcast Osama bin Laden tapes, the channel that broadcast beheadings, the channel that broadcast enmity against the Americans, all these kind of accusations were false.
Al Jazeera never broadcast bin Laden tapes or beheadings.
We did broadcast bin Laden tapes based on very clear code of conduct, very clear professional standards, like many other international networks.
Mm-hmm.
We have portions of these tapes followed by contextual analysis and opinions from all over the show, especially American opinions. The second issue, which is important, the issue of beheading, we have never, ever shown one frame of beheading. Factually, they are wrong, and we corrected them, and I wrote to them, but none of them wanted to stop criticizing Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera was a scapegoat for a lot of failures and a lot of mistakes in the region.
What's Al Jazeera's relationship with the Obama administration?
Developing in a positive direction. We have much better dialogue at this moment in time. This is my second visit to the States. I have been to the White House. I have been to the State Department. And we have hosted on our screen Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden. And I think they are more aware at this moment in time of the role that Al Jazeera is playing in defending democracy, expanding the issue of human rights, and introducing different paradigm of thinking to the region. So definitely it is much better than before.
Now, Al Jazeera has a couple of dozen channels, and one of them is Al Jazeera English, which broadcasts all around the world and is available in Washington, D.C. However, it's had trouble finding a national distributor. Can you tell me why the world needs Al Jazeera English?
Al Jazeera English has a philosophy of reporting the voice for the voiceless. Al Jazeera has the most diverse newsroom in the world. We have 50 nationalities from all backgrounds, religions, and races. We are trying to create a great model whereby the Asians are reporting about Asia through a broadcasting center in Kuala Lumpur. Europe, we have a broadcasting center in London. In Washington, we have a broadcasting center of at least 200 people working in it. So we are a TV station that is truly global and at the same time trying to enable journalists, regardless of their origin and culture and religion and backgrounds, to practice journalism based on the principles that the forefathers of this profession created decades ago.
And that principle is voice for the voiceless.
Don't you feel that sometimes our media is trying to concentrate on stars, superstars, and ignoring the margin, ignoring the human being? The amount of commitment that our audience have towards Al Jazeera, they embrace us, not because we are politically correct from the point of view of governments, which most of them are authoritarian. No, we are full of pride and determination because the public out there think of Al Jazeera as their own. They own it. So therefore, yes, we will continue, but definitely we will face trouble. So what? Let us face troubles. We are journalists. If we choose this profession, we should choose it for a mission, to be committed to the audience, to truth, and to allow space for transformation to be correct and right. How could the Arab world build future if 65% who are under 30, you know, 65% are ruled by authoritarian regimes, no democracy, aging regimes, corruption, and so on and so forth. The only voice that is trying to challenge this status quo and say there is something wrong, please let us fix it, is Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera is on the foremost power of creating democracy and freedom of expression in the Arab world.
Wada, thank you very much.
You are most welcome.
Wada Kanfar is Director General of the Al Jazeera Network.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Alex Goldman, Peter Henderson, and Lynn Davis, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Dylan Keefe.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.